Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, one of us is about to be underwater, though. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 91 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday night, Larry. How are you?
Just doing great, Andy. How are you?
I'm well. Oh, wait, it's not Saturday, is it?
It is not.
We had some technical problems last night, and we had to shut it down. So here we are. It's Sunday.
And it's going to be very late before this gets edited and out. So those of the of our regulars who sit patiently on Sunday afternoon waiting for it to come, or Sunday morning, we apologize. It's all on me.
I wasn't going to bring that up. You pressed a button, didn't you?
I pressed the button, but then our tech team couldn't figure out which button I pressed. So
I have no idea.
Go back and figure it out.
I still don't know what button you pushed.
Well, I'll show you after the podcast.
Okay. I would actually like to know what you pressed, because I was baffled for, what, an hour and 15 minutes of trying to poke at your machine?
So was my regular tech support from here. She was baffled.
Very good. Got a bunch of articles, and we got a deep dive on some legislation, and then we have a listener, kind of like a workshop thing going on. But first, Larry, this one is super duper fun to talk about. This one, I still don't know how we get here. But for the first time, the Maryland Court of Appeals said it had to grapple with applying the state's child pornography law to minors who consensually engage in sexting. And when we get there, you're going to give a little bit of synopsis, but we're going to bring Brenda Jones, who's the executive director of FAIR, which is the NARSAL affiliate there in Maryland. What is going on here?
Well, this deals with a relatively new phenomenon when you're as old as I am, but for the last 10, 15 years, the evolving technology has made it possible for teenagers, rather than showing themselves to one another in private, they show themselves to one another through sending an image through their phones, and thus the term of sexting. And through the decades from the 70s, when the push became to protect children and minors from being having their images being abused by transportation, which was largely in postal those days, but by transmission of images, the laws have failed to keep pace with technology. So now a person who transmits images of a minor, even though it may be the minor themselves, can be convicted of a sexual offense and be required to register. So this is a case out of Maryland that we're going to take a deeper dive into. And it's from their Court of Appeals, which when you hear Court of Appeals, you think of intermediate court, but this is actually the state's highest tribunal. So this is essentially the Maryland Supreme Court.
Okay. All
and
right.
They have a ruling that came out on the 28th. So it's late breaking news in terms of it probably came out Friday afternoon or whatever. And we've just got a chance to dive into it over the weekend.
I'm still completely baffled by the notion that you take a picture of yourself and send it to somebody else, and you have committed a crime that you couldn't really be committed of. It's just so weird to me. I do make the analogy, and I don't know how right it is, that if you were to attempt to commit suicide, that they would then turn around and charge you for murder. That's to me, that feels like the analogy. It just seems so stupid to me.
Well, it's not quite the same analogy, because the suicide, if it doesn't work, then you're alive. If it does work, you're gone, and it ends. But an image that's sent out through phones can be retransmitted, and what you may intend as a private image of yourself, in this case, for example, became fairly widely disseminated. So that's the issue of what was trying to be addressed by the law that this person was prosecuted under, was that we don't want these images out circulating, because next thing you know, old geezers will have access to pictures of teenagers, and we can't have that.
We don't want people that your age having pictures of pretty much anybody.
That's right.
All right.
By the time you're as old as I am, you should be beyond any type of sexual urges.
And then we have a new patron, Larry, and I'm super excited about having new patrons. We're welcoming Nate to the Patreon family. Thank you very much for signing up, Nate. And I can't extend enough thank yous and appreciation for you and all of the other patrons and all of our listeners, but our patrons especially. Thank you again, Nate. Welcome.
So now we're at 99, right?
Yes, we are just about to cross 100.
We'll get there by the end of the year.
It could very well happen. Let's start diving into some of these articles. I think that's where we are in the show notes on the rundown. What is you put stuff in here, Larry, and I do not know where you're headed with this one. And this is Governor Cuomo, right? He's the governor of New York, right?
Yes.
All right. Signs a bill reinstating a 6-year statute of limitations under Martin Act. I have no idea why you would put something in there that has relationships to Wall Street on this podcast.
Well, it was for twofold. I frequently bash legislatures in the South for trying to undermine the when the court Louisiana, we've had King Alexander on, and this is not just unique to in a particular region of the country, but if the courts rule on something, legislatures often run to fix the problem. So in Louisiana particularly, the legislature goes and tries to countermand what the courts have decided should be the interpretation. So they reword the statutes. Well, in this case, this is a feel-good thing for the liberals who are in control of New York, and they have decided that the statute of limitations on securities transactions, which arguably are less damaging to society, some people make that argument anyway, that they need a longer statute of limitations. Well, that's what happens when you start wrecking the statute of limitations. You go down this train of what's next and what's next and what's next. It sounds good. Oh, it sounds really good when you're going after the vultures who are sexual offenders. But this is a slippery slope. So this was done as political motivation, because right now the Trump administration is controlling the DOJ at the federal level. And they're not as going to be as zealous as the Obama administration was, which they weren't nearly zealous enough, in my opinion, on those who sunk the economy in 2008 with their fraudulent activities. But this is a feel good reaction to, we're going to show those white collar criminals that we mean business. So they simply changed the law on the statute of limitations, because the court had interpreted the way they read the law that it was a 3-year. So they said, well, we'll make it darn clear. So that was the only purpose in there, is that we're on that slippery slope of the statute of limitations.
I'm thinking about the Bernie Madoffs of, would there have been transactions that fell outside of the statute of limitations and his whole Ponzi scheme that people couldn't collect damages for, that this may help them get some sort of closure, whatever the word would be?
Well, you're bringing up two different things. You're talking about civil versus criminal. I think okay. This deals with the criminal prosecution here.
Okay.
The statute of limitations for criminal prosecution. But with Bernie Madoff, I don't know that there was any statute of limitations problems, because some of those things, they consider them to be a continuing transaction. And therefore, as long as the fraud is continuing with a particular victim, it doesn't matter the begin date. It matters that it continues. So if they had an account, were holding funds for you since 1979, and here it was whatever year he crashed and burned, it was sometime
2008.
In the 2000s. You know, if he had been managing your, if he had been committing fraud and sending you bad bogus statements for all those years and misrepresenting it, that would have been a continuing crime.
Okay,
and then when you didn't have access to your money because it was all gone when you went down, then you finally recognized when people started cashing out. That's when the Ponzi scheme collapses, because they can't bring in enough new investors to replace the money that they've already embezzled.
It's hard to earn 20% interest for many decades running, and that not be some sort of scam.
Well, that's the thing that puzzles me about this. These people are very sophisticated, successful people that fall prey to these schemes. So you go through your investment career being told that there's no free lunch, that your life is about hard work and making wise decisions, and some person comes to you and says, "I can exceed the market returns, decade in, decade out." Well, if you've read one book from Warren Buffett or from Graham or any of the great investors, you can't really beat the market over extended periods of time. So yeah. if they show you a 20, 25-year period where they've been getting above market returns, your antenna should go up quite
you would
high.
Think.
And say, really, I just don't believe that this is possible. But they show you these glossy reports, and it looks really, really, and they're very convincing. We had our version of Bernie Madoff here in New Mexico, Doug Vaughn with the Vaughn Company. It was, of course, much smaller, but it made headlines here because he was successful in defrauding some very shrewd, sophisticated people around New Mexico with his scheme.
It's very strange. Very strange. He got like all kinds of nonprofits had put their money into his whole, you know, this whole scheme, and all of that stuff just collapsed, and it's all vapors, and there's not even any, there's no meat left that you could even recoup anything. It's just gone.
So, well, and the nonprofits tend to be vulnerable because they have volunteer boards. Sometimes they don't have a lot of sophisticated people on the board in terms of financial sophistication. Not to mean they don't have sophisticated people on the board, but that's not their expertise. You may have three lawyers on your board, and they may not do any investing to speak of. And these people don't understand this, and they're under the gun to try to get more money coming into their foundation, to their operation fund. And these fantastic returns are very appealing to them because it helps them meet their obligations to fund the organization. So if they're promised 18% a year, wow, that sounds really good.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, well, let's move on to another article. I'm sorry, and that one was from law.com. I didn't even bring that one up. Sorry about that. But the next article is coming out of CNN, and I'm a little puzzled as to why you would bring this one up, too. This one seems a little, I don't know, off culture for what we're trying to cover, but it's a West Virginia GOP state senator accused of soliciting for prostitution. I don't know. I don't think that we typically try to, like, I don't know. We don't want to bring these kind of things to light necessarily, but you had a specific reason of why you wanted to bring this up.
Well, I'm bringing it up because the solicitation for prostitution is certainly not one of the most heinous crimes that one could be charged with. But even assuming that he might be guilty, which that he's not right now, he's only been charged, so the presumption of innocence, I would like to be intellectually honest about the witch hunt that's ensuing. I mean, there are all these calls for him to be thrown out of office and thrown out of the Senate. He hasn't been convicted of anything. He's merely accused of this action through an undercover operation they were running in Glendale, West Virginia, which I have no idea where that is. But he was charged with which is relatively a minor crime, and he pleaded not guilty, and it carries a maximum of 6 months in the county jail and a $100 fine for a first-time offender.
Yeah, it seems to be pretty petty punishment for it.
Pretty petty.
6 months and a $100 fine
for merely asking someone to engage in sex with you. That seems like a pretty significant amount of punishment if you sit in jail for 6 months for that.
I'm looking, okay, for what it is. I'm wording that then wrong, but just that amount of, like, the $100, whatever, no big deal. But yeah, I guess the 6 months plus all the exposure of him, I'm going to assume he's married, you know, and it doesn't look favorably for this guy, obviously. But what should we do, Larry? I mean, I know that when I can't remember the guy's name, back in the 2000s, there was the French prime minister. He got accused of doing something naughty with a maid and other sexual scandals. And they have, like, a strict policy of no perp walks and stuff like that. And they kind of, I think, they lock this stuff down. I don't think that we could do that in the United States, of keeping this stuff off the airwaves.
I don't think we can with a free press. But I think what we can do is that we can pinch ourselves and say, this man is entitled to be presumed innocent until he decides and elects to plead guilty, or until a tribunal, I don't know if he's entitled to a jury trial on an offense of that, with that only 6 months in jail, that may be below the cutoff, but until he's convicted or decides to plead guilty, he's an innocent person. Hello?
But they wouldn't even, like, accuse him if they didn't have evidence, right?
Well, that's fine. They may have evidence, but it may not be enough to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
And reasonable doubt means that's, like, the highest threshold, correct?
That is the highest threshold we have in terms of the evidentiary burden. And he has the right to go to trial. He has the right to force them to come in and testify against him, whatever witnesses they have. And he has the right to be presumed innocent until the day the gavel falls. And we've Absolutely. Forgotten that in this country. So that's why this is in here. So even though he's a Republican, it makes no difference to me. He is entitled to that same presumption.
I understand. Yeah, and we totally don't do that. Like, if someone is fleeing from the police, we shoot them. And I know I'm exaggerating but it does happen, Eric Garner. It just keeps happening that we are convicting, accusing and convicting people long before anything happens for there to be due process. And I'm bringing that up to say, in comparison to, like, we have this whole Constitution and you have your First Amendment, you have your Second Amendments, you are entitled to due process. These are things that are supposed to happen, but we are chopping that short almost at every corner.
Well, the citizens that elected him will ultimately be the determining, and I don't think it's going to bode well for him politically. I'm just imagining that it's just not going to be a political winner for him. But people do survive criminal charges, at least here, around here they do.
And didn't Anthony Weiner then get elected after the original scandal?
I'm not sure on that. But this I don't believe he did. But this is okay. this is not for when you win an election to serve the constituents of your district, you are there until the constituents don't wish you to be there anymore, barring some heinous misconduct. And to my way of thinking, trying to have sex is not heinous misconduct.
Yeah, so, I agree with you. I agree with you. Somehow our society says that you shouldn't do these things like have sex. It's very strange to me. Also, well, let's move on. We're going to head back over to law.com, where you decided to grab a whole bunch of articles from law.com this month, or this week. And this one is, a judge in Epstein's case should not turn the dismissal into a drama for the victims. I mean, the guy's dead. Doesn't that mean the whole case just goes away? I mean, there's no defendant. So what is the judge supposed to do?
Well, that's the whole point of the article, is that the judge is going to hold a hearing on the prosecution's desire to dismiss the case, and he's going to hear from victims, alleged victims.
Why?
Well, that's the whole point of the article. We're asking the same question. Why?
Can you opine? Can you extend yourself out to his position of why you would then want to hear from victims of a dead guy, of an alleged dead guy? Well, the guy's dead. Alleged perpetrator of it. Sorry, I got myself all twisted up.
I don't know, other than speculation. It could be that we have a judge, it says last week, Judge Richard Berman ordered a hearing on the prosecutor's decision to dismiss the indictment. It could be that we have a judge who feels that they have been empowered to be the moral conscience of society. I'll detour just a little bit. Those of their old enough to remember the airline named Eastern Airlines.
Okay.
Are you old enough to remember that?
I do, vaguely. They went under, that's like American, what was the other airline? Was it American that went down around that same time?
American's alive and well.
Then never mind, not that one. Pan Am, that's who I'm thinking of.
So, Eastern Airlines, I think, quit flying in either 90 or 91, and they put themselves into bankruptcy, and as a bankruptcy protection, the responsibility is to protect the creditors, because they have skin in the game. They've extended credit. Well, the bankruptcy judge, I can't remember his name. I think his name might have been like Lifeland, but I remember the trustee quite well. His name, Martin Shigrew, who the court appointed to be the trustee, and Martin Shigrew decided that it was his personal calling in life to save a national treasure called Eastern Airlines, because it was in the interest of competition and the mobility of Americans to have that carrier fly. So he continued to dispose of and got Judge Lifeland, if I've got his name right, to release funds until the carcass of Eastern was almost not enough to do an orderly shutdown. Well, this judge may feel like that you know, we got $500 million, and I predicted the estimated value of the state, and he may feel like that it's his moral calling to see to it that these people have their day in court, even though the person's dead, so they can tell their story, so that it will help them get a portion of that carcass that everybody's got their paws out to get. That's a speculation. I have no idea what's in Berman's mind, but in all the years I've seen, I have never seen a hearing on a dismissal because a person's dead. I've never seen this before.
I get that the victims of the alleged perpetrator, I guess is the way to word that, they don't have quote unquote closure out of this, other than that I'm sure many people are happy he's gone at this point. This just feels totally like some dog and pony show.
It is a dog and pony show. I don't think they're happy he's gone. I think they wish he was actually around.
So that they can watch him suffer and go through the process?
Well, so they could put on, I mean, he was not going to get anything that resembled a fair trial.
Right.
Had he gone to trial. But the article says the procedural rules of federal criminal cases do not provide for posthumous trials. Okay, so that's essentially what it sounds like this judge is about to have.
Yes.
So that's why I put this in here.
Okay, is there a procedure for someone, would that be the defense side, to try and shut it down?
I hope there is.
That's bizarre. So now we have like complete legal theory that no one ever thought of anything of this nature, so there's not even a process in place to try and shut it down, so someone has to pull a rabbit out of their butt to figure out how to shut it down.
There's some brilliant lawyers working for Epstein's estate, so I'm certain that if there's anything to be thought of, they'll think of it.
Interesting. Very bizarre. Very bizarre. This one actually kind of blows my mind too, Larry. This is another, the finallaw.com article. This is Harvey Weinstein's sex crimes trial delayed after he pleads not guilty to new charge. Why would the trial, I'm confused on delaying the trial because he pleads not guilty. I don't understand what's happening now.
Well, I think they've added charges and more complexity and or made some rulings that's changed the nuance of whether someone can testify. Since the change to the charges was intended to open the door to actress to testify against for an actress to testify that's beyond the statute of limitations. So they've apparently filed a new indictment, but at least he's free on bond.
I was just about to bring that up.
And he's at least able to participate in his defense, unlike Epstein was going to have. But again, I'm wondering how fair this trial is going to be.
I think that one's doomed. So, I mean, he's already, you know, before anything happens, he was, I don't know, top dog in Hollywood, so to speak, at least one of the top dogs. And that's obviously his own company booted him off and, you know, untold fortunes being spent on the attorneys to try and defend himself. I'm kind of curious, though, of how he got out on $1 million bail and whatchamadookie didn't. Epstein didn't get out.
Well, the difference in the systems, he's not in federal court.
So Weinstein is just at the state level, so he was able to get his way out on bond.
Yes, he's in New York state court.
Those were federal charges for Epstein. Those were issued in New York, right?
Yeah, but they were federal. He was charged federally.
Okay. All right. Hmm.
You remember when I talked about the Bail Reform Act and the prior to 1984, before the BRA was passed.
I think so. Yeah.
We talked about that. A huge number of federal defendants are subject to some type of confinement, not as heinous as what Epstein was subjected to, but it's very rare that a person doesn't have anything confining them while they're pending trial and presumed innocent. I think we've got listeners that can vouch for that. I know Brenda has some experience with that, but the confinement of Epstein was a very hardcore. Tough correctional facility in New York, but this guy's under state rules, which are apparently okay. a little more lenient. He was charged in state court.
Mm-mm-mm. All right, off to the appeal we go. I like this article, Larry. This one's fun. Pennsylvania County owes $67 million after a man finds his arrest records on mugshot.com. As I understand it. This individual whose last name, I'm really not even going to try and pronounce the names, but it's Taha is the last name. He got arrested and then just did a short period of time. And in doing his little plea deal, so to speak, he got his record expunged. But then I think it was 13 years later, he ends up on mugshots.com and sued. And so my understanding then is that he can't sue mugshots because they are not part of the Criminal History Record Information Act for Pennsylvania, but he's able to sue the city or the state for letting those records go.
I think it's a great thing.
He should be able to sue mugshots. I mean, that's bogus. That's garbage information that someone then says, hey, okay, you'd like to get a job, and they go look up at mugshots and they find, oh, hey, you were arrested and now you get denied a job, you get denied housing. There's just a cascading domino of effects that shuts you down.
But if the state is releasing it and they released it by mistake or intentionally, mugshots would not have been the one who had the error on their part. It's
fair.
If you're going to get a voter registration list from the county clerk, you assume that these are registered voters, and mugshots would have assumed Not that I have any respect for these people that purvey information and sell it, but they would have legitimately been able to claim that we assumed that he had this arrest record that was not expunged. If it had been expunged or sealed, we wouldn't have gotten it. So
right.
that would be the reason why they got dismissed from the lawsuit.
Hmm.
But it's important that it says about 1 in 3 working age Americans have a record of some sort, including non-conviction arrests.
Yeah, you just end up at a club where a drug bust goes down and they just haul everybody in and, oh, you weren't involved, so they let you go. But you got arrested and booked.
Yes, and it says if they were a kid drinking underage at 18 or 19, that shows up. And so it's one of those things where we're going to have a discussion in this country about arrest records and criminal convictions, but more importantly, arrest records that do not result in a conviction. Or that the conviction has been sealed and set aside.
And then he goes to mugshots to try and get the information removed, and they charge $400, and they say a business model that added up to $2.4 million in removal fees over 3 years. So they're making $8.8 million a year in removal fees. That's crazy.
Well, it takes staff time to go through and purge their system. Do you expect them to be doing this for the goodness of their heart?
I would think that the guy did get arrested. I mean, like, that part isn't really necessarily in question, but this is just a feeding frenzy for buzzards to come up with something. Oh, hey man, I found you on this thing. And it's just garbage. It's tabloid kind of stuff. It's paparazzi.
Can't believe that a person as much of a capitalist as you are would be wanting to try to interfere with the free market of people doing their entrepreneurial spirit of figuring out how to earn money off of these taxpayer-created records that have been created on the public dime, and for them to come in and get these usually pennies or for free and to be able to sell them. I don't know why you have a problem with that. I don't know why you would even have a problem with them charging hundreds of dollars to remove the record that they got for free. What on earth is wrong with you?
Charge them to remove the record they got for free. I like how that gets worded. I'm interested in the integrity side.
What are you trying to? Are you trying to destroy this country?
No, I know you're playing with me. I'm baffled. Like, how are you supposed to move forward? These people are just being bottom feeders, really. I guess is the way to put it.
Well, doesn't our system in general permit a lot of bottom feeding? Isn't that what we do?
Certainly.
Don't we have businesses? And argue, there's an argument for both sides, so we don't need all the hate mail. But aren't businesses that provide payday loans at these astronomical rollover fees every week that they charge you $35 or $50 to rewrite a $250 loan so that you can come in next Friday? I mean, aren't they bottom feeders?
I've heard, yes, they are totally bottom feeders. But the thing that makes that somewhat different is the predatory nature of it. And I'm with you. I don't know, like, should government protect people from making bad decisions? And I think the answer to that is no. But at a certain point, I guess yes, because you shouldn't let people make completely egregious, stupid decisions.
You shouldn't? Under what theory? Where is that in the Constitution?
Certainly not in the Constitution. People? But if someone's able to hit you up for what turns out to be like 1,000% annual interest, you are never going to get out of that cycle. You're just doomed.
You are, but they would argue, and here, but I'm not taking a side for the moment on this. But they would argue that the traditional resources in the way of credit are not available to these people because their credit is usually shot.
Yes,
or non-existent if it's not shot, but their credit is often shot because they've not been able to manage credit responsibly. They will tell you that in order for these people to survive, that we provide them the bridge that keeps them from being evicted and helps them make it, and we're actually doing something good. And you would want to stand in the way of folks being helped by the only resource that they feel like they have left out there to them?
I know that they are, like, quote unquote, the lender of last resort. Wow. Mm-hmm. All right. So mugshots gets to stay, according to Larry.
Well, they're merely taking their free records that they've got that were created at taxpayer expense, and they're merely selling them and the removal service. That's pretty creative, isn't it?
Tell me. All right. I'm going to try and make this comparison. I don't want to beat this dead horse that bad. But the advances that NASA, the research that NASA does, as I may word this wrong, is supposed to end up in the public domain. That's how we end up with Velcro, for example. Is there a parallel there that these records are at the state and the county's expense, and they end up that these people got it for free? Is there some sort of similarity here that this is the yin and yang of it, that the public benefits from NASA, and I'm not going to say that the public benefits from mugshots, but that's where I'm headed.
Well, there is a benefit to a small group of people who, and that is a in my mind a good analogy. People that say that I did everything for themselves, I did this all myself. I think Dick Cheney said it when he was when he got his going away money from what was the name of that drilling company, the big drilling company.
That's not Blackwater, is it?
No. It's bigger than that. But anyway, he said, and I want you to know, the government didn't have a damn thing to do with it. And I'm thinking, really, Dick? You actually do believe that? You believe Halliburton? You believe that Halliburton would be the success it is if we didn't have 20 aircraft carriers at great public expense projecting power all over the globe, so that Halliburton can operate in these far away flung places that are in unstable parts of the world? You actually believe that they would be the success they are today? Really, Vice President? I don't think so.
Right.
But people don't associate any of their success to what collectively has been provided by our collective contributions. We succeed because we've put into the system together. And we have an orderly society. We have national security. We have public health. We have infectious disease control. We have infrastructure. We have ports. We have food inspection. We have all these things that we collectively contribute to. If we remove all those things, I don't care how hard you work, all we'd have to do is drop you off in Somalia or South Sudan. You will not make the money you make here.
People are leaving, is it Venezuela, and they are walking to like Chile? I mean, I can't even fathom how that goes, because the government is collapsing over there. I can't even imagine how that would be.
Oh, but all right, we've had a political show tonight.
All right, I'm sorry. We'll stop. How about we talk about the Washington Post? Because that's not a politically charged debate on its own, is it? But out of the Washington...
What do we have from the Washington Compost?
Ah, see, there you go. You said it. Prosecutors say he's been wrongfully in prison for 24 years, but a judge won't allow a new trial. I'm really, really baffled at two. If the person is innocent, if the prosecutor says, yes, we effed up, this person should be free, how does the judge not then go, okay, let him go?
Well, it says right here in the article, the judge's reason, prosecutors missed the deadline to file the motion by approximately 24 years.
Come on.
Circuit Judge Elizabeth Hogan said court rules require defendant Lamar Johnson to file his motion for a new trial within 15 days of his conviction, even though the prosecutors only uncovered new evidence supporting his innocence in recent years. So she's following the letter of the law. And I thought that you were a textualist who believed in following the letter of the law. That is what the rules say, right?
That's what I hear people say that they are.
All right. Well, then aren't we in that category that we believe that we should follow the rules? And the rules say that he's beyond the scope of filing that motion.
I there's no position in here that the government takes that goes, whoopsie, forget all that stuff that's written down on the piece of paper. This is the right thing to do.
Well, not being fully apprised in the vehicles that can be used. Clearly, the judge is interpreting that as being a vehicle that's not available. But there's usually other vehicles that can be used. It may be that the habeas corpus is time barred. It may be that Missouri has a petition for a writ of quorum nobis, which is an old ancient writ that could be used. There may be other vehicles that could be used, but in this particular instance, that vehicle is apparently not going to achieve the result.
So, in the case of these different vehicles that you talk about, someone could file one, and then the judge goes, nope, sorry, that can't be used. And it doesn't matter who's on the other end of that. It's the most sympathetic kind of defendant on the other side of that. And the judge says, I'm sorry, we can't do that. That doesn't work here. So try again.
Well, the judge is supposed to be neutral. So the judge could telegraph. I mean, courts do that from time to time. We see it in rulings. They say we would prefer this to come to us all using this vehicle. Declaratory judgment, for example, is the best vehicle to use when you're challenging the requirements of sex offender registration. People often try to challenge it as part of their conviction. And I remember the Maryland court system said, we'd like to see this come to us in declaratory judgment. It did, and they ruled in favor. It may be that this coming through the right process, if there is a process, there again, I don't know if there is the process. It stands to reason there would be a process to cure a manifest injustice. So there would be some writ that could be filed, but apparently a motion for a new trial is not going to do it.
That is just bizarre that you, and then there's an economic toll on that too, that they're spending whatever $30,000 or $40,000 a year to keep the guy behind bars that shouldn't be there. Then you've lost the income potential, the human capital, the tax revenue, all that stuff. It's like everything's going in the wrong direction for a wrong that was committed 24 years ago.
Oh, well, the courts are also worried about the floodgate. If you grant this outside the rules, the scope of the rule, then all of a sudden, Where do we draw the line on what the rule for this vehicle is? So I can understand why. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I can understand their reasoning that they don't want to open a floodgate of people saying, well, okay, my conviction's wrong also.
I understand what you're saying, but this one has like everyone saying except for the judge. And I'm not saying that the judge is saying no, he shouldn't be let out. The judge is just saying that we don't have the vehicle to let him out, but he's like the top prosecutor. I'm assuming that's the DA of, what is it, Missouri, is saying that this guy should not be guilty. What about
the judge is not saying he shouldn't be out. It's saying I can't grant your motion for a new trial.
Right. So is there some sort of avenue where like new evidence gets brought up that they could open up a new trial or retry?
Well, apparently, like I say, we just go for both of us or just looking at this article with the information.
Yeah.
Apparently, there isn't such a process, but it stands to be to reason that there is.
Yeah,
and they're going to have to find it. It may be coram nobis, it may be the federal courts. He may have to file a habeas corpus petition if he's not time barred. See, again, we run into the issue of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. When you get into federal habeas, you have 1 year from when your conviction becomes final, and you've appealed it to the highest tribunal in the state to file a petition in federal court. So he may be time barred federally, but there, if there is such a vehicle, he may have to resort to executive clemency. If the prosecutor were to approach the executive, assuming the governor of Missouri has that power, and says, I really would appreciate if you consider a pardon for this person, there ain't no way he did it. It would be hard for me to imagine that the governor would say, nope, I'm not going to even consider that.
Very bizarre. Very bizarre. Can you, this writ of, what is that word you keep using?
Coram nobis.
Coram nobis. Can you give me a very, like, third grade level? Explain like I'm five is what I want you to say. Can you translate that for the dumb people like me in the audience?
Well, it's an extraordinary writ that's not even available in all states, but I know it is available in Arkansas in some states, and it's designed for this very situation where there's actual innocence, and it may be that it's available in Missouri. I do not know.
Okay.
But like in Arkansas, there's only like four grounds that you could use that writ for. And I can do a little research and probably find what those four grounds are, but it's not widely used because it's very narrowly tailored for the purpose that you can file one of those. Otherwise, there would be too many of them. We can't have that.
Right. No, we wouldn't want that. We wouldn't want innocent people out of jail. That would be bad.
Well, we don't want we don't want the floodgate of perpetual litigation on convictions.
Yes, I understand that the person has already been convicted. You don't want just everybody just bringing up saying, hey, I'm innocent too. Try me. I understand what you're saying there. Well, I don't know that we've ever had an article from BuzzFeed, Larry. So this is from BuzzFeed News, and we're going to bring Brenda Jones from FAIR at the Maryland affiliate to have a little discussion about this one. But I'm still baffled by this stuff. A teen sex, this was our feature thing at the top. A teen is a child pornographer for sexting a video of herself to her friends, a court ruled. I like this is, if you saw the movie Inception, this is totally Inception. So why don't you two bat it around and see what comes out of this? Welcome, Brenda, first of all.
Howdy, howdy.
So you people up there in Merlin are really strange people.
Merlin.
Don't blame it on all of us.
This case is one we've touched on last summer. I don't remember the episode. I don't know if we can identify it, but we had a discussion last year. Do you remember when that was? It had to have been June or July of last year when we talked about this very same case, but it was at a lower level of appeal then.
I do remember it. I don't remember when it was.
Yeah, we had, I remember it because I was having a lot of fun with it. It was about the time the Nebraska Supreme Court ruled that a person that had a juvenile adjudication from Colorado had to register, and they ruled on the using a textual interpretation. And I looked at the Maryland Court of Special Appeals, which is their intermediate court of appeals. They had ruled in June of last year on the same case that juvenile SK was in fact guilty, and they denied her appeal on one ground, but they granted it on the other. They said that the mechanism by which she transmitted it was not covered by the statutory language because the outdated language didn't cover a cell phone video. That the language was written in terms of video cassettes and the technology that existed at the time. And we talked about that, and I said, well, all the listeners out there are big textualists, and so they should be shouting for the mountaintops. They've got two recent appellate level decisions that are textual in nature because they went right by the – well, that's this case. Both parties filed for asking the highest court, which is the Court of Appeals of Maryland, to take a look at it. And so they granted the cert petition, and they reviewed the case of SK. So this is the case of Inri SK, just released on August 28th. And like all teenagers, SK sought to impress and humor her closest friends. During the 2016-2017 year, the 16-year-old female maintained a group chat on her cell phone for text messages with her best friends. And the group chat was used, among other things, to send silly photos and videos in an effort to one-up each other. The trio hung out together and trusted one another to keep the group messages private. As part of the one-up competition, SK sent a one-minute video of herself performing fellatio on a male. And later in the school year, when there was a falling out among the trio of friends, the videos were distributed to other students at the school and shared with a school resource officer. As a result, the state attorney for Charles County filed a juvenile petition alleging criminal charges under Maryland's child pornography and obscenity statutes. Now, where is Charles County? Would you be able to highlight where that is at Maryland?
I've never heard of it.
I believe it's the southern part of Maryland.
So
I could be wrong. So because I'm horrible at this.
It's not an urbanized area around Baltimore.
Charles is definitely not an urbanized county.
Okay. It is, yeah. So, it's on the interior of the Potomac River, southwest side, like straight south of Washington. It's a pretty big county, though.
Yeah, it is a big county, but it's largely rural.
Yeah. How many people are in it? 37,000?
146.
146, all right.
And that's 146,000, not 146 people.
Mine shows 159, but it's still not a lot.
Okay.
That was in 2017.
Okay, yours is more updated than what this is. My intent here is to try and help our listeners when they hear that we have these crappy laws to try and, like, what questions would be asked by the you kinds of people, Brenda, of the expert kind of Larry people, to try and figure out what questions, who do you try to get, like, how does this whole process, how does this brainstorming session even begin of how would you try and make this change so that this does not happen, because this is asinine.
Well, what's asinine about it? They're following the law, Andy.
I understand. This is stupid. This law is stupid that you're going to saddle this 16, 17-year-old girl with all this baggage and overhead that the registry causes.
Well,
let's
do a deep dive in that. But it is the law.
Yes.
She was charged count one, filming a minor engaging in sexual conduct in violation of CR 11207A2, count two, distributing child pornography in violation of CR 11207A4, count three, displaying the unobscene item to a minor in violation of CR 11203B1.
Right. Okay. All of those are her.
No, that's not her. She was performing fellatio on a juvenile male.
Yes, she filmed it. She's the juvenile that filmed it of herself Yes,
performing
on
another minor. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So now we're having a discussion here about the law. Now the law was designed for before we had cell phones, and this is
correct.
A case where there had been no updating of the law to reflect the evolving society. But at the time that they drafted this back in the they started drafting, I think Maryland, I read through the decision, started drafting their protection for minors back in the 70s. Filming was relatively rare for
and very expensive.
I doubt very many teenagers were filming anything back in the 70s.
No, they would have gotten the equipment from the school, from the AV department, whatever.
So, but this hasn't been updated for a long, long time. But if you look at the statute, she did film a minor engaged in sexual conduct. She did distribute that. She's the one who sent it out, according to all the evidence in the case, and she did display it. So what you're saying is a prosecutor should just put their hand on the Bible and say, I'm going to enforce the law, and then they should just ignore this altogether, and that would be one approach. Or we could say that the court should ignore the letter of the law. It does. People are prohibited from filming minors engaging in sexual conduct and distributing that. So the courts could say, well, the legislature did not really mean that, and we're gonna second guess, and we're gonna insert our moral values here of what the law ought to be. Or they could do what this court did. The court said, well, we don't like it, and we think the legislature ought to consider changing it. But she is a minor herself, but she did film a minor, and she did distribute it. I mean, we don't understand why, but there's all this hocus argument. I mean, she violated the law.
I understand. I will comply.
Well, no, you don't.
I understand what Larry's saying.
You're still pulling your hair out.
I just think this is stupid. No, I understand that they drafted in the 70s where the equipment, the technology, none of that existed, and they are protecting children from most likely adults doing this filming thing. I totally get that. This, we have cell phones. We've had them for a good while now, 15-ish year. You've had the capacity to do this sort of thing. And for our adults that are writing these laws to not have seen this coming. We talked about the thing in Colorado not terribly long ago where there were like 100 videos and pictures being shared around. They didn't prosecute. So this is essentially the same thing, just with one person. And all you adults that go do this lobbying stuff didn't pick up on this and fix this to prevent this from happening up front.
Well, but let me defend all of us adults. First of all, there's very few of us adults that do this, because most of the people that ought to be doing it are hiding under rocks and not actually showing up. So we have a very, very skeletal staff showing up. The law enforcement apparatus is well represented. I can't imagine that the law enforcement apparatus would show up and ask this law be changed, because as far as most people would concern, they would have your reaction when no one would ever prosecute someone for this. So therefore, because the prosecution is overworked, short of staff, and the criminals are running rampant in society, and they have so much to do that they would never bring a charge like this. So therefore, we don't need to worry about this. So now that this has been illuminated, I suspect that this would present an opportunity to have that discussion. But if you had gone around the halls of Annapolis trying to find someone who wanted to change this, if Brenda, for example, had said, well, I'm going to start spending my non-existent time trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist before this actually became apparent that it does exist, and start knocking on lawmakers' doors and say, we got the possibility that, you know, since technology has evolved, that minors are going to be prosecuted. How would you feel if your teenager got prosecuted for a sex offense? They would look at her and they would roll their eyes and they would say, why don't you come to me with a real problem?
All right, Brenda, you're walking around the halls of Annapolis. Figure it out.
Yeah, I'm walking around the halls of Annapolis. Yeah, I would not have had any idea, not being a professional anyway. I didn't know that this kind of a thing could happen based on the current laws. So I wouldn't have been walking around in previous years. But Larry's right. If without this case that has now, you know, hit the news, I don't think I would have had any standing to walk around. I think they would have been rolling their eyes and say, "What? Don't you have anything better to bring to us?" With this in hand, I might be able to walk around and see if I could find some sponsors and say, "Don't you want to fix this? Do you really want our teens getting prosecuted for this?" we could see if we can make some progress on it this coming year.
Well, Larry, are you able to go to another state and copy their bill,
you could copy ours.
Oh,
we have a complete carve out where juveniles can't be prosecuted for this. As far as I know, we're the only state. All of them other than New Mexico, they have this lesser crime, and they get them treatment and counseling, and they divert them from the heart. We just plain out say they're not eligible for prosecution. That would be the one I would start with. But what you'll have is you'll have your attorney general, and you'll have the law enforcement apparatus, just as we had, pushing back mightily against that, because they'll say that this is a slippery slope and that these kids need to at least be brought to our attention so that we can make an individualized assessment if they need this type of intervention and what level of intervention. So therefore, you're taking away a tool that society will be degenerate to chaos if we don't. I mean, But I'm not hyperventilating. That's exactly what the attorney general did.
Yeah, in your state.
That's exactly what he did. And he continues to do that. He continues, since that passed in 2016, he continues to go around the state in his Crimes Against Children unit, putting on presentations saying how vulnerable our kids are, because now they can send these pictures and God only knows what's going to happen bad next.
They're going to explode.
We can't bring them in the system. But I would start with that. Realize you're going to have a very significant pushback from the law enforcement apparatus, because they're going to want you to believe that they won't prosecute people and that they will use prosecutorial discretion, and that only the most egregious
look at this young lady.
That's
exactly
the whole point.
That's the point.
You need to take the power away from them. They will not use it responsibly.
Yep.
I've taken to your side, Larry, that I very much like the position that you take. Is like, oh, they'll do it. They'll use prosecutorial discretion. No, they won't. They'll take the opportunity to put another notch in their belt and say, look, I'm tough on crime and I have all these many XYZ convictions. Well, doesn't matter that it's a 16, 17 year old girl just kind of doing something stupid. But
there are some good prosecutors who would not have prosecuted this case out there. But we don't need a society where the vaginal or the ovarian lottery.
Yes, the ovarian.
You don't need an ovarian lottery in terms of whether your kid gets prosecuted, because the prosecutor there in that jurisdiction happens to be more reasonable, because you wouldn't have known that your prosecutor that you voted for, because they promised you law and order and all the things that sounded good, you would not have never imagined that they would have turned that arsenal on you. And once they turn it on you, you don't have the ability to change the trajectory, usually, unless, like in that case of Colorado, where so many people rose up and said, no, we can't have that. But in this case, this teenager was represented by the public defender. So I'm guessing from that account and the opinion that she did not have huge amounts of wealth available to her.
That would be probably a good assumption.
If you roll it to like that Colorado thing where they had all those kids and it was a pretty affluent community, that they had the money and the political power and the representation to keep the prosecutor from going after him, where this chick didn't have it so much.
I would say that there's no doubt about it. When you have more economic power, you have more political power. But the Colorado situation was referenced in this opinion. The opinion is for the legal junkies. It's a good read. I've highlighted various sections throughout. It was not even a close call. It was 6-1. There was only one dissenting judge.
Yeah.
So you've got the whole court almost in unison saying that, sorry, we don't make the laws. We merely interpret them. She is a person. She did do this. And we don't understand what the hoopla is about.
Brenda, what else?
Hey, I'm waiting with bated breath to get that legislative language, and I'll see if we can gear something up. I'll try to talk with my folks and see if we can get something launched.
The one other thing that I wanted that was in the article, it says Maryland is one of 22 states that has not passed legislation to amend its child pornography statute since the advent of sexting, the court noted. Seems like you guys are a little bass-ackwards.
We're a little behind. Well, we might just review the whole shebang while we're at it, just to see what's there. There was a bill last year that was, one of the things, I don't know if that passed or not. Do you know, Larry? You were looking at it, I think, yesterday.
I think it did, yes.
There was a bill last year that just clarifying or adding moving pictures to pictures. So they didn't have the language. They were making sure that you understood that when they were saying pictures, that included video, because there wasn't anything in there about video. Now, I have no idea what the story they were telling, the videos are, nobody can prosecute for a inappropriate video because it doesn't say video. It doesn't say moving pictures in the statute, but apparently somebody felt the need to fix that. So
for the legal beagles and the junkies that do go read this, on page 12, I highlighted, we do not find any ambiguity in the text, and therefore it is our duty to interpret the law as it's written and apply its plain meaning to the facts before us. And then they cited a 1987 and 1965 case. And then at the bottom of that page, we refuse to read into the statute an exception for minors who distribute their own matter. And thus, we believe SK's adjudication as delinquent under CR 11207 must be upheld. So now, you textualists, you should be proud of this court. They did not invent any law that's not there. There is no exception in the statute for minors, and they didn't legislate from the bench. They didn't create an exception for minors. So this would be a proud day for those who believe in textual interpretation.
And if we want an exception for minors, we have to go put it in there.
We do.
So. Brenda, I have a sort of off-the-wall question for you. Are you sitting on your porch, or are your windows open, and are there crickets cricketing?
There might well be crickets. I've got my headphones on, but my microphone might be picking some crickets up.
I keep hearing little chirpy chirpies. All right.
Well,
thank you so much, Brenda. I hope that you and Larry can formulate a strategy to knock their teeth out and make this so that this doesn't happen, because this is asinine. God, is this asinine.
That's pretty crazy. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Sure.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, I don't understand. It sounds like to me you're not in favor of the law being enforced.
I do feel that since they said that they did not find any ambiguity in it, that they did their job and they didn't color outside of the lines. And they did then say, you guys maybe want to go revisit this statute. So like they did their job, but they said, hey, go back and fix this. I guess it feels more right in them doing it, but it still seems like this is just garbage that this girl's going to be saddled with this for umpteen gajillion years.
She's not saddled with it. She was adjudicated as a minor. Her record is sealed, and she's not registering, so she's done with this.
Okay.
But the irony
gets a little bit of relief.
Yeah. She's fully rehabilitated as far as this. She was just doing this to help others.
Okay.
She did not need to do this to help herself. But the irony of this is that the special court, the Intermediate Court of Appeals decision, was better for her than what she ended up with the highest court. And the point I like to make is everybody says, we better get this to the Supreme Court. I can't wait to get this to the Supreme Court. Sometimes the intermediate level courts actually have a better grasp on it. Just because they're the Supreme Court, that doesn't mean that they're going to be more favorably predisposed to your way of thinking. And in fact, we find our Intermediate Court of Appeals here in our state to be more favorable to the criminal defense than the state's highest tribunal. An example we have, thanks to the late Justice Daniels, who just passed away early this morning, thanks to his bail reform, we have a model very similar to the federal system where people can be held without bail. And the decision to decline release was overturned by the Court of Appeals. And the state, of course, appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reinstated the trial judge's decision that he was to be held. Just because they're the Supreme Court, that does not magically make them going to be see it your way or be predisposed to your way of looking at things. Now, I was glancing through this about the in the footnotes. In footnote 24, it says, in response to the Court of Special Appeals decision, delegates C.T. Wilson from Charles County introduced House Bill 1049 in the 2019 session, which would have decriminalized the distribution and manufacture of child pornography by a person younger than 18. And during a hearing on the bill, the House Judiciary Committee Delegate Wilson testified that he introduced the bill because he disagreed with the decision of the state's attorney for Charles County to pursue SK. The bill did not make it. After the March 6, 2019 hearing, the committee took no further action. So that would be one for Brenda to take a look at. And I thought I had seen this in here, but I couldn't give her a bill number when we talked about this prior to coming to do the recording.
All right, then.
So take a look at House Bill 149 that did not get out of committee.
Okay. I don't know that I've very often mentioned Reddit. Reddit's a very interesting website. It is. They call themselves the front page of the internet. And this documentary, it came back up on my radar. I've watched the documentary before, but it is where a U.S. Prison warden goes over to check out the prisons in Norway. And so it came back up on my radar, and there's a bajillion comments. And I only brought it up to A, if you haven't seen the documentary about the prison systems over there and how different, I mean, not even close in comparison it is to the United States. But some of the comments in here are just fascinating, the way that people write. And I don't know where these people are coming from. I'm trying to remember. Let's see. I moved my mouse around, and I'm trying to find where I got the where my quote was. Dagnabbit. They do say something in there about how prison food is better than school food, and I can almost guarantee you that that is not a true statement. There's no way in the world that prison food is better than school food. Have you watched the documentary, Larry? I'm assuming no.
No.
Are you familiar with how the prisons are over there?
I have heard, but that's not going to happen in our lifetimes in this country. Our society is hell-bent on people suffering when they're incarcerated. And they see that as the Holiday Inn resort. And that type of incarceration, that type of treatment, that type of rehabilitation, that is not going to happen here.
So is it even worth trying to look at something like this and try and model, even push ourselves in that direction?
Yes, it's absolutely worth it. You begin the discussion and you implement small little bits of what they're doing. But if you were to try to build a prison, propose a prison, I don't even care if you go to the most liberal state you can find in this country and try to propose a prison like that, good luck with your political career.
Yeah. Here's one of the ones that I did want to find. It says, the longer I think about that quote, and it says that we are the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. It says, the more that I feel sorry for the people living in the States, the fact that people get upset about inmates in Northern Europe getting treated like actual human beings says a lot about the society in the US of A.
That's my point.
Yeah, I'm with you. So, like I said, there's a lot of good comments. I honestly don't think I saw anybody saying anything ridiculously negative from the U.S. point of view of saying, hey, well, they did the crime, they should do the time, and they should be tortured and punished and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, you can find a link in the show notes to it.
So for whatever Wikipedia is worth, we can go back to Coram Nobis. That way I can say I'm reading from Wiki, and this is not my legal opinion. It says the writ of Coram Nobis, also known as the writ of error Coram Nobis, is a legal order allowing a court to correct its original judgment upon discovery of a fundamental error. And I would say that what state was that in again that we were talking about?
Missouri.
Okay. That did not appear in the records of the original judgment. And then it goes on and then it lists the states that where it's still available in this country. It says the writ of Coram Nobis still exists today in a few courts in the United States. In 1907, the writ became obsolete in England and was replaced by other means of correcting errors. Now, the states it lists here do not include Missouri. So,
right.
So to whatever accuracy you can count for Wikipedia, Missouri is not on this list.
You can pretty much count on it to be accurate, unless you're going to go look up George W. Bush's record, I guess it was. That was one of the pages that just constantly... It's a good place to get like a general overview, and if you want to then be more accurate, go check sources and other things. But it gives you a good like Cliff Notes, so to speak, version of it. It's pretty reliable.
And since, assuming this is accurate, if that vehicle is not available and there is not a vehicle, it may be executive intervention is the only thing that would be an option.
Wow. Oh, okay. Well, so the governor could quote do clemency or whatever that would be.
Yeah, if the governor possesses pardon powers, or if they, not in the case of Georgia, the governor.
Oh,
does not
right. I was just going to bring up Georgia. Jesus.
The prosecutor would, if it were Georgia, they would petition the Board of Pardons and Paroles, mm-hmm. and they would ask the parole board to view this new evidence and to cut the person loose. And they might or might not do it. Georgia would be a better chance of it happening because they have a politically insulated board.
Yeah, okay, that was going to be my next question. Is one better than the other one? And I guess it depends on which side of the equation you're looking at it from,
well,
too, right?
From our side, I'm assuming that most people listen to this. I'm thinking overwhelming or not on the side of law enforcement and trying to convict people. From our side, a politically independent board or process is far more favorable than one that's not. This case, although it sounds good in the story we read, for all we know, because we didn't dig deep enough into it, this could have been a heinous crime that was the crime of the century. And it may be that politically that there's so much hatred for this individual that to pardon or release them or commute their sentence would be politically detrimental. I don't know that. But if you have a process like Georgia has, where there's a great deal of insulation between the politics of it and the release of someone, you have a better chance of it actually working the way it's intended to do. But very few states have the Georgia model, and you guys down there are trying your best to wreck that. There's people actually on our side that are pushing for abolition of the current system, which was put into place decades and decades ago to cure the perceived corruption of the previous process, where you went and bought yourself a pardon from the governor.
Okay. Wow. All right. Do you want to set up the Scalia clip, or do we just want to run it? It's kind of long.
It's not that long.
It's two and a half minutes.
We've run longer than three, but it's about a little bit about textualism and about the. I was trying to looking at the text and people. They're constantly getting bombarded with me about textualism because it has its drawbacks. There are times when reading the text will serve you well, and those opportunities, I will pounce on them and say, "Oh, we should go straight by the text." But you don't want someone who universally says, "That's all I do is use a textual approach." But yeah, go ahead.
All right, here we go with some Scalia.
If you give to those many provisions of the Constitution that are necessarily broad, such as due process of law, cruel and unusual punishments, equal protection of the laws, if you give them an evolving meaning so that they have whatever meaning the current society thinks they ought to have, they are no limitation on the current society at all. And the whole purpose of them is eliminate. If the cruel and unusual punishments clause simply means that today's society should not do anything which it considers cruel and unusual, I mean, it means nothing except to thine own self be true. You know, we think thumbscrews are bad, but you know, if you think thumbscrews are okay, God bless you. It's not cruel and unusual if you don't think it's cruel and unusual. So, you know, I interpret it the way it was understood by the society at the time. And if you don't... Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't new things that come up. Of course you have to apply the text to new phenomena, which the founding generation didn't even know about. But as to the extant phenomena, whether the death penalty is cruel and unusual, whoever voted to make it impossible to have the death penalty... Or to make it impossible, for that matter, to have the death penalty for anyone younger than 21 years of age. Whoever voted for that? Nobody. You make out of the Constitution something that it was never meant to be. And it's all done by a Supreme Court, which is probably, of our political institutions, the one... least capable of understanding what the current society really wants. We're not supposed to know what the current society wants. That's not how we're supposed to vote. So why are you going to, you're going to entrust this institution with keeping the Constitution up to date if that's what you want to do, which it shouldn't be? You know, even if that were the object, you've picked the worst institution. Do it the way England does it if you want to keep the Constitution, make nothing of the Constitution. That is to say, the English Constitution is whatever Parliament says. There's no such thing as a law of Parliament that violates the Constitution. Parliament is the trustee of the Constitution. Well, if you believe in the evolving Constitution, that's what we ought to have here.
Well, there you go. What do you have to say about all that? That was a lot of words.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of words, but it's clear. It's clear to those who've been following that he's not a big believer in evolving. We're going to have a clip next week where he talks about same-sex marriage and how that was an invention in the Constitution that's clearly not there. So textualism has its dangers and risks. It also has times when you can say, gee, this is good. By the text, you can't do this. And believe me, we're going to be using that in our state, in our litigation. We're going to say, huh, the text doesn't permit you to do this. We're textualists all of a sudden. But just to have a rigid belief that you should follow the textualist view, I think if you listen to a number of our podcasts, I think some of you ought to be having second doubts and second thoughts about whether you always want to be a textualist.
I agree with you very much that there do seem to be places where, I mean, like the judges in the teen sexting thing, like they just followed what they were given, what the legislators wrote, and they just had to judge in that regard. But they can only rule by what the law says, and I guess if there's ambiguity, and the legislators could eliminate ambiguity if they write clearly enough to make it so that the judges don't have to interpret, they just have to follow what's there.
Well, they had another choice. They could have recognized the evolving society, and they could have said clearly that this wasn't contemplated, and clearly it's our job to correct an injustice, and clearly we have the power since we're the court, and we answer to no one other to what he said, to thine self be true. They could have said, we're going to graft in an exception that just isn't there. But that is not what a textualist believes a judge should do. A textualist and people who believe in the strain of judiciary does not believe that it's their role to fill in the gaps of what was missed by the legislature. This is squarely in the hands of Annapolis, the people that are elected to represent the population of Maryland. Now, if the value system of Maryland believes that teenagers should not be brought into the criminal justice system for doing this, they can fix this. And they can even fix it retroactively. There's nothing that stops them from writing into legislation that it'll be fixed retroactively for anyone who's been prosecuted, that their conviction shall be overturned and withdrawn. Now, that's very difficult to do politically because the prosecutors, they go ballistic and say, oh, it's going to be a lot of work to go back and reopen all those cases and to figure out how to undo all this. We didn't have any trouble letting the genie out of the bottle, but we're going to have trouble putting it back in.
Fair enough.
That can be done.
Are we ready to do this little final little deep dive? I hope you did your homework.
I didn't.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to throw you under the bus and call you out on it. We 6 months ago, we covered a story where a kid got interrogated by some law enforcement that he did the same thing that this chick did then, I guess. He took a video of him, maybe even the girlfriend did it. Anyway, there was a video of them two doing whatever they were doing, and they got interrogated, the boy got interrogated, and they left the room, and then they let him go, and he goes and finds the nearest garage, and he jumps himself off of it. Here is like the aftermath of that there is a bill that was just signed in the last handful of days that I want to get your as much of the take as you were able to dig into this, that they went back and they to some degree they fixed this, you know, they patched some holes, whatever. I'm hoping that you can expand on all that went down in preventing this sort of behavior by the law enforcement apparatus, as you call it, in the future.
They did indeed, and it was actually led by a student of the community, and then by his lawmaker, I can't pronounce her name, so forgive me, but Representative Stephanie Kifowit, I guess that's the closest I can come to pronouncing her name, but she introduced some legislation in response to this tragedy.
to place limitations on what the police can do. And of course, this is one of my big things about, I don't understand why we are so hesitant to actually tell the police what you're allowed to do. But there's all this great reverence and hesitancy to do that. But the legislation was introduced in the Illinois Assembly, filed on February 14, 2019 by the representative, and the process, it's a little different than what we do in our state. Apparently, the way they do it is they run things, each amendment through a different process. We don't do all of what took place here would have been much more compressed. It took place in Illinois would have been much more compressed here, the way the amendment process took place. But there were multiple amendments in the House, and then it passes the House after sponsors signed on galore. After the amendments, the bill was introduced on February 14th, and then by April 10th, there was a litany of House co-sponsors that jumped in.
Yeah, it looks so like everybody
liking what was happening, and then it passed the House on third reading on April 11th. And see, by then a significant number of delegates were on board, and then it goes into the Senate and it gets amended again. And we could spend an entire podcast and wouldn't be able to go through all these amendments. But the language it ended up with was a little uncomfortable for the mother. She felt like that the absence of a parent or guardian, they gave the authority for the school to put a person in place if the parent or guardian wasn't available. She was a little uncomfortable with that language, but she felt it was a significant step in the right direction. But this thing went through the Senate, amended, and then it had to go back to the House because it had been changed, and it had to go back to the House for concurrence because they have to both pass, both chambers in a bicameral have to pass the same bill. So it went back to the House, and they concurred on June 1st, and it was signed into law by the governor on August 23rd, and it was passed by a huge margin, which made it applicable immediately. It took effect immediately. And we call that an emergency clause here. And if something has an emergency clause attached to it, then it has to have a supermajority. And it passed with the supermajority. And so it's already in effect. So this is an example of a tragedy resulted in some positive movement to limit the actions statewide in Illinois of calling a juvenile into this situation with no one there and interrogating them to whatever degree. I don't even know if there was any video exist of what they did to this young man, but interrogating this person without any adult parental supervision, and to the point that he goes off and commits suicide. As I said at the time we talked about this, you people ought to be ashamed of yourself that this happened. And now I can be somewhat proud of you that you've actually done something about it.
This, and I totally wanted to highlight this. That's actually a client of mine that alerted me to this, that lives in that town. And she, she was very much in favor of all of these things being passed. But I just thought it was a neat example that if we can muster the support, and, you know, this is a super duper high end tragedy that someone would throw themselves off of a garage, that created the next level of action for this to go through and take place with such overwhelming support. I'm sure that we wouldn't get this level of support on trying to reduce residency restrictions, for example. But it's just, you know, we, the people, can make these things happen if we, you know, not if we only try, but other things have to go into play. But without trying, it's sure shit's not going to happen unless we try.
And I don't know that I agree with you completely that we can't. I think if we could bring families into this picture and bring them into the legislative process like this young man did, and if we had the articulate family members of registrants explaining the harm that this is causing them, and we brought in child psychologists to explain experts on these things cost money. They're seldom pro bono.
Right.
But if we could bring in the people to testify, I think we probably could have a significant impact on this, but that's all wishful thinking because most people, they're not willing to make the trip to the Capitol. They're not willing to have their 14-year-old testify. We don't have the money to hire experts, and we end up on the short end of the stick because the law enforcement apparatus has all these resources available to them.
I do understand. And maybe I overspoke on how little there are certain situations where we would be able to get some kind of relief instead of we have people in Florida living under bridges.
Well, those people oftentimes have families as well. I mean, they're the people that end up homeless because of the registry, they're not just single men.
Correct. Yeah, I do understand that too. And do you think that even the people in those situations, like the family is just that they have no ability to help them because they can't live in their house. They're not going to move their house. They may have kids there, et cetera. And then they just have to throw their hands up and go, I can't help you. There's nothing else I can do.
I understand the question. I know that some people do leave home because their family can live there without them. Is that your question?
Basically, yeah. And I know that some of them, like, you know, they'll ride the bus and they'll go hang out with family and be in their neighbor. They just can't live there. But the family just has to, you know, a fallen soldier, you know, never leave a fallen soldier, but like they almost have to because there's no alternative for them either.
Well, what would happen hypothetically? Let's say that, you know, in the years I've been in this advocacy and we hear all the people, you know, I'm not allowed to be around my own kids because PO won't let me. What would happen if a significant number of those kids showed up at the Capitol and said, I miss my dad. My dad can't accompany me to my ball games. I mean, you know, the victims are pretty well at getting tears to fall. If you had people come in saying those things, do you think the lawmakers would say, well, you should have chosen somebody other than a sex offender to be your parent?
Well, your dad should have thought better about those things before he decided to commit his crime, right?
It's the emotional appeal that could be made. I don't know how effective it would be because it hasn't been done. But I can tell you this, they would be treated well, they would be treated with respect, and you would have people engaging in some serious thinking after they did it. I haven't been able to produce one teenager to go to the Capitol. In all the years I've been doing this, I have begged and pleaded, and I have not been able to get one person who has an articulate teenager to bring them to Santa Fe.
Hmm. Okay. And you have your tentacles all over the place. I'm assuming like you haven't heard of it being done in any of the other 73 states.
I have not heard
states.
Of it being done. I've actually encouraged it in Nebraska also, but I've not heard of it being done. But
Brenda says she had a teen at hers one year.
One time. Okay.
So we have one out of however many states times how many legislative sessions.
So, but I think that to be effective, we either have to accept that our strategy is not working and just throw in the towel, or we're going to have to revamp our strategy, which means vastly more resources and thinking outside the box. And we need to look at the tactics they use, and they use emotion, and we have to try to emulate what they do because it works well for them.
Right. Yeah, I understand that too. Wow. All right. I think that's it's actionable information that I was trying to bring to the show for the evening of what ideas people can have in their heads of how are we going to make these things better for ourselves in the future. That was my intent. Maybe you guys could let me know in the comments if I did bring something inspirational and helpful. But Larry, we need to grow the podcast. Where can people go on the interwebs to find the show?
So that's a very careful thing that you have to do. But if you go to Registry Matters... .co, you'll find our homepage.
Okay, great. And how about a phone call if people want to leave a voicemail?
If we don't get another phone call this coming week, we're shutting down because I said that last week. So we have to follow up.
You did
up.
Say that. So we're going to have to follow up. So what's the phone number?
747-227-4477.
If people want to use that old-fashioned email, what can they do?
RegistryMattersCast@gmail.com.
And our favorite way for people to support the podcast, what can they do?
They can subscribe at any level, beginning as small as $1 per month at patreon.com. And that's patreon.com/registrymatters. But even if you just get to patreon.com, you can search Registry Matters. I found that actually works.
It does work. It does, for sure. Larry, as always, I so greatly appreciate your insight, expertise, and your brain dumps that your vast array of 300 years of life have been able to assemble together in that little cranium of yours. I greatly appreciate it.
I appreciate being here, and I apologize for the tardiness of the
whatever.
It'll podcast. Right. I clicked the toggle switch on my computer, and it baffled all the tech gurus to figure out which one I clicked.
There are so many. As always, Larry, and I hope you have a great Labor Day weekend. And as to you all out there in listener land, and have a great night. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.